You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
Last night, on my orders, America's armed forces began strikes against ISIL targets in Syria. Today, the American people give thanks for the extraordinary service of our men and women in uniform.
US and Arab forces begin striking Islamic State targets inside Syria as the fight to destroy the militant force gathers pace. Mary Dzhevsky, a columnist at the UK's Independent newspaper, and Phil Clark of the School of African and Oriental Studies will join me to discuss that and the rest of the day's key stories from around the world. Also ahead, as the General Assembly opens at the United Nations in New York, the British Prime Minister David Cameron announces meetings with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, the first such talks since the Iranian Revolution in 1979. We'll assess what the key talking points are likely to be. And before the end of the programme, we'll trace the history of black cinema through an extraordinary collection of its film posters.
There has been a separate cinema, something that kind of paralleled the Hollywood system and the regular system that marginalized blacks, and something that made African Americans a little bit more proud.
All that, and we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world, speak to the founders of Amy Grindhouse, one of the most novel and visual events in London. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here on the next hour on Midori House. But before all of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. President Obama has hailed the support of Arab nations in airstrikes on Islamic State militants, saying it was not America's fight alone. Speaking hours after the US and five Arab allies launched their first airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria, he said there were many more offers of help from across the world.
Over 40 nations have offered to help in this comprehensive effort to confront this terrorist threat, to take out terrorist targets, to train and equip Iraqi and Syrian opposition fighters who are going up against ISIL on the ground, to cut off ISIL's financing, to counter its hateful ideology, and to stop the flow of fighters into and out of the region.
A Pentagon spokesman said he expected the attacks to continue for some time. Rear Admiral John Kirby also told reporters the U.S. government had been aware of a specific threat posed by the Khorasan group.
The Khorasan group is an offshoot of al-Nusra, so it's an al-Qaeda affiliate. We had very good indications that this group, which is a very dangerous group, was plotting and planning imminent attacks against Western targets to include the U.S. homeland. And it was on that basis that we struck targets, Khorasan targets inside Syria. We knew that there were there was active plotting going on for an attack on the U.S. homeland. I won't be able to go into much more detail than that, but we were aware of it.
Israeli troops have shot and killed two Palestinians in the West Bank city of Hebron. The military said they were members of Hamas responsible for the killing of three Israeli youths in June, an attack that led to the Gaza war. The victims, Marwan Kawazmi and Amar Abu Aisha, were shot dead during a gun battle after Israeli troops surrounded a house in the city before dawn. Israel had been hunting the men for 3 months. Reports say an 18-year-old man who'd made threats against Australia Prime Minister Tony Abbott has been shot dead in Melbourne. The man had been under surveillance as a person of interest and was being investigated over claims of terrorism. Two police officers were reportedly stabbed by the man before he was shot. World leaders, including US President Obama, are holding a summit on climate change at the United Nations. The aim of the New York meeting is to galvanize member states to sign up to a comprehensive new global climate agreement at talks in Paris next year. It's the first high-level gathering since the Copenhagen summit in 2009. Hong Kong's striking students have given the city's leader 48 hours to honor his promise to listen to the people. They're threatening further action if he fails to respond to their demands for greater democracy. The students face a showdown with Beijing over its decision to rule out fully democratic elections for Hong Kong's next leader in 2017. Around 13,000 have joined a rally at a university campus to mark the start of a week-long boycott of classes. The World Health Organization is warning that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa could infect tens of thousands of people in the next few weeks. In August, the WHO predicted up to 20,000 cases in the next 9 months. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. It's currently 18:05 in London. You're listening to Midori House, and we're right back after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here in London, and the time is currently 18:06, which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Mary Dzhevsky, a columnist at the UK's Independent newspaper, and Phil Clark of the School of African and Oriental Studies here in London. Welcome both to the programme. Late last night, American military aircraft, in collaboration with the air forces of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Jordan, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, launched airstrikes against Islamic State targets inside Syria. President Obama, speaking at the White House, hailed the cooperation of Arab states as one of the key pillars of the fight against the militant armies, stating that the fight against ISIS is not America's alone. Mary, when we look at the lineup of people here attacking these targets, it's a bit of an unseemly crowd in a way, because many of these people, we believe, only months ago were funding these very groups.
Yes, I mean, that's true. And so is the fact that we don't actually know what proportion anybody actually contributed to this. So it looks very much like a facade that's been built up to show some sort of Arab solidarity, or what actually looks more like some sort of Gulf and Levant sort of solidarity. And I'm not sure how long that facade will endure, because obviously the guiding force and the guiding military might here is the United States.
Phil, also when we look at the past attempts at kind of bombing our way out of trouble, when we look at even, you know, airstrikes, for example, in Libya, and now we look at the state that that country is in, without a huge amount of diplomacy, without a kind of follow-up plan, it doesn't always end very well just hitting these targets, does it?
No, and you'd have to question how many lessons the West has learned in the last 10 years about how to fight these kind of wars. I mean, I thought it was ironic that the Iranian president was out during the week saying, look, if the US is going to rely on airstrikes, this isn't really going to do the job, and kind of cajoling the US into putting ground troops into Syria and Iraq to try and deal with Islamic State. When you're getting kind of, you know, military advice from the Iranians, you probably have to have a good hard look at yourself, but this looks like a kind of another knee-jerk reaction. No real sort of long-term solution in place here, and we'd have to be very skeptical as to whether this is in fact going to do the job.
Mary, is there actually any solution possible? Because I wonder, in the American eyes, what their best hope for is almost what was happening, you know, to be honest, in Afghanistan, in a way, is that you bomb people into a bit of a stalemate. You use drones and you use these kind of remote ways of attacking people. You know, you're not having as many troops on the ground, although of course they did in Afghanistan, but you just kind of pin people down a bit. You confuse the situation.
Yes, I mean, I think for all the sort of bombastic rhetoric and, you know, we must destroy this evil force and words to that effect that's coming from the United States and several other places, nonetheless, that actually is not what this is about. This is about making a gesture. It is about stopping, or trying to stop, Islamic State in its tracks. And, you know, I remember some of the writing about Afghanistan, you know, as recently as about a year ago, saying, well, actually, the ideal situation, given that nobody is going to win, is actually pinning both sides down, keeping them busy, keeping things static, and to an extent that not exactly minimise the casualties, but it reduces the pressure on Western countries to do anything about it. And I think maybe that's really what this is about.
Phil, do you think there's a hidden agenda here as well? Because, you know, over the last couple of years, we've seen it's absolutely impossible for governments to get past their kind of legislature, the idea of kind of bombing to help the so-called moderate forces in Syria. Suddenly, we have attacks going on, which actually will kind of help the moderates as well. Because, you know, if you take out the Islamic opposition, you're suddenly these groups we haven't even sent them a bullet in many cases. We've been trying to send them a few night goggles and things to kind of get by. Suddenly, we are helping them in a back route, aren't we?
It is extraordinary to see how quickly these airstrikes have been authorized. I mean, given that the hoops that Obama tried to jump through with Congress last year and the difficulties that David Cameron and others had trying to get past Parliament here to authorize these sort of attacks. So this is quite remarkable in that sense. Although I think with all of that said, had there been airstrikes last year, I think various commentators in the region have said that that may have actually exacerbated the situation in Syria, could have in fact given a real boost to Islamic State as it was starting to consolidate its territory within Syria. So again, I think it highlights the unpredictability of these types of strikes, that there may be a certain range of intentions by Western governments when they engage in these kinds of attacks, but it's not guaranteed that, in fact, this is going to have the outcome that they expected.
Mary?
I think there's another agenda here, too, which is a very American agenda, that President Obama has come under all sorts of fire in recent months for not being decisive enough, for not using American power, for not showing world leadership. And when you saw him coming out today onto the White House lawn, standing at the podium and saying with exemplary gravitas that last night this, that and the other happened, this is a signal to his critics to say, no, this guy isn't as wimpish as you're painting him. So I think there's an internal political dimension to this too.
So why do you think there is the kind of appetite to do anything at all? You know, we know that there are these similar groups in Nigeria, throughout the Sahel. Why suddenly here are they willing to do something? Is it because we've seen Western hostages being beheaded? Is it because there's oil? What's the motivation for thinking this is actually the battleground they need to get reinvested in?
I think it's very hard for any Western government to get past just how horrific the media presentation of Islamic State has been. And I think it's impossible for any Western leader to sit there while there are, you know, pictures of people being beheaded on the TV screens of the average citizen. I think they're kind of forced to react. I mean, even today in Australia, where I'm from, there's been an alleged Islamic State attack or attempted attack on two police officers in Melbourne. Whether that's kind of controlled centrally by Islamic State, I think, is another question. But the fact that there are actually actors using that title and trying to affiliate themselves in attacks inside of Western governments does ramp up the political pressure. I mean, I think in the case of Australia, what we then see is a government that is looking for an excuse to foist itself onto the international stage to try and protect itself at home. We're looking at a very beleaguered Conservative government in Australia that has used situations like Ukraine and the crash of MH17 and Islamic State as a way to try and gain credibility for itself, fighting battles on the international stage to try and get some points at home. So I think that many of these attacks overseas do play into these very complicated domestic situations, as Mary suggests.
Let's look at a couple of the other unintended consequences of this, Mary. You know, first of all, for President Assad, is this a good moment, a bad moment? What do you think they're thinking in Damascus?
I think on balance, it's probably quite a good moment because it's showing intervention that is essentially and in its effect is on the side of Assad. Now, you know, there are people who will not see it like this, but the most negative comments I've heard on the American action in Syria has been that indirectly it helps Assad. And this, is the exact opposite of what the Western powers were trying to do a year ago. So I also think that there is more communication going on than is being made public, because the Americans initially said, well, no, they weren't going to inform President Assad. Then they said, well, actually, there had been a conversation. Assad says, you know, there was or there wasn't. And the whole thing about this is that it should be deniable for Assad so that he doesn't look as though he's basically handing over part of his sovereignty to the Americans. At the same time, of course, if, as it appears, he's being, if not consulted, then informed, then that increases his stature.
Well, another one of the unintended consequences, and something that kind of flows from this, is, you know, the news today that there's the telephone lines actually between Tehran and London. Those very dusty telephones have been shaking back into action. Prime Minister David Cameron has said that he's going to meet President Rouhani at the General Assembly. How significant is it? Mary, actually, I'll come back to you, Mary. You know this scene very well. Tell me how significant you think this is.
I think it's very significant, but not as significant as maybe it's being played up. It's very significant because the British have provided for many years a back channel for the Americans and for others wanting to keep communication, if possible, just a little bit open with Tehran. And one of the points on which the British and the Americans have disagreed over the last 10 years, really, was about the need to talk to Tehran. So I think it's not by chance, as it were, that Cameron is being given the kudos of having, as it were, this first meeting. On the other hand, I think it's very well known that the president's power in Iran is nothing like the power of the supreme leader and the theocracy. So that while Rouhani has been greeted as a relatively friendlier face towards Western powers than his predecessors, nonetheless, his room for manoeuvre is probably limited.
When we look at Rouhani, it's funny when you're sitting in the West, you always imagine that, you know, it's the Iranians hoping that, you know, that discussions will get going again, that there'll be a thawing. Actually, as Mary was saying, for Rouhani, it's kind of a bit complicated. He's probably just as cautious about speaking to Cameron for his own public as well. Do you think both of these players are going to be very unsure on these kind of first diplomatic dates?
I think so. I think Rouhani's extremely limited at home. I think he's going to be very cautious. He's also very limited in terms of the region as a whole because, of course, as we've already mentioned, he has backed Assad's regime in Syria very, very heavily over the last couple of years. And so on the one hand, you have Rouhani very keen to target Islamic State. On the other hand, he doesn't want to ruffle Assad and he doesn't want to undermine him. So Rouhani's maneuverability in the region as a whole is also extremely limited. So there's a strange sort of game of chess going on here with a couple of moves forward, sometimes a couple of moves sideways, but a real lack of clarity in all of it, I think.
Mary, you want to jump back in, sorry?
Yes, because I think that the... if we look back a week, there was a big meeting of more than two dozen leaders in Paris talking about how to tackle Islamic State. And the meeting was held, obviously, under France's auspices, but seems to have been under the guiding lights of the Americans. And the interesting thing was that while the people who were there were saying, well, obviously, Iran is a bit of a key player in this, the Iranians weren't invited. And the people who were invited made something of a point of saying that Iran was still persona non grata. Now, at the same time, somebody else was invited that was equally interesting, which is that the Russians were there. The Russians sent their foreign minister to this meeting about measures to take against Islamic State. And that is very peculiar because if anybody is regarded as made to look an international pariah at the moment, especially in Europe, it's Russia. So you have to ask what we're playing at as well as what everybody else is playing at.
Now, just before we move on, for both of you, the idea of having a policy on what to do in the region, just the things we've just described now, the shifting sands of kind of who backs who and who believes what and who's been helping who, it makes it, if you're sitting, you have some sympathy, somebody sitting in, you know, in Paris, in Washington, in London, it's quite hard to know how to play this game. On balance, do you think over the last couple of days it's been played in the right way?
I think it's been very messy. I mean, I think particularly from the US and the UK's point of view that they've struggled even to articulate a very clear bilateral strategy with any of the states in the region. They're suddenly now in a situation where they really need a regional kind of viewpoint on all of this. And quite often their relationship with one state will undermine their relationship with another. So I don't think that there's a very sophisticated approach to this. It seems extremely reactionary or almost being made up on the back of an envelope on a day-to-day basis. So I'm sympathetic to policymakers in that sense. I think this is undoubtedly a very complicated region, but we're not seeing a very sort of clear set of thinking at the moment.
Mary, your take?
No, I agree. And I would go back to one of the questions that you asked before about the role of the media and the way what's going on there is being communicated. Because I think these pictures of beheadings have created popular pressure for something to be done. Even though when I look at this from my perspective, I say, well, that's taking it all out of proportion. But it shows the very canny appreciation of how Western politics operates that Islamic State is actually making these videos and putting them out there.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Jajewski, columnist at the UK's Independent newspaper, and Phil Clark of the School of African and Oriental Studies, also here in London. When we return, we'll assess the likelihood of greater autonomy in eastern Ukraine and ask why Norway is paying Liberia not to cut down its forests. Stay with us.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luskin every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Mary Jajewski, a columnist at the UK's Independent newspaper, and Phil Clark of the School of African and Oriental Studies. Thousands of protesters converged on Moscow yesterday to protest Russia's role in the crisis in Ukraine. Government figures put the number of protesters at around 5,000, while observers suggested something closer to 26,000. Well, over recent weeks, with the focus on the war in Ukraine, there has been an attempt to think how political autonomy could evolve in that region, pulling away from Kiev. First of all, let's just look at these demonstrations. It's slightly extraordinary, isn't it, Mary?
I have to say that I had a complete double take when I saw the reports of this. I was aware that there was a peace movement operating largely on the internet, the blogosphere. But the idea that, you know, whether it's 5,000 or 25,000 people were actually marching through Moscow, unmolested, it has to be said. There was no violence. This demonstration was not broken up. Which, you know, there are so many things about this that are extraordinary that I think it's worth your while spending just this time just to point that out.
Phil, when we think about Russia at the moment, it seems to be that we see the operation of TV channels like Russia Today that the show on UK services what Russia's thinking, and we know that it's a very kind of different view to what we normally think of in the West. But the strange thing is here is potentially thousands and thousands of people sitting in Moscow thinking the news they're being given, they don't believe it.
Yeah, and we keep hearing that everything that's happened in Ukraine in the last year or so has played to Putin's benefit at home, that he's been able to whip up this nationalistic frenzy and gain an enormous amount of electoral popularity for himself. But I think what's happened in the last couple of days shows that that's not entirely the picture, that there clearly is a remnant of protest. There's clearly a section of Russian society that's deeply unhappy with what's happening in Ukraine, and they're willing to get out on the streets and actually express that. So I think at least for those of us on the outside, it is a reminder that there are much more complex goings on inside of Russia than often what we see and that is often depicted by the Russian and the international press.
Mary, you described it as a kind of a peace movement, but I wonder if there's other things kind of nagging people. It's a country that's been used to kind of a bit of an economic boom and a bit of a consumerist boom at that. I presume some people are worried about their standard of living. And I also wonder, actually, we know that there have been Russian troops killed in the fighting, but there's nothing covered about that in the newspaper. I wonder if there's just a bit of an unease flowing through some of the Russian informed public who know stuff that isn't appearing in the papers.
No, I think that's entirely true. And I think there are, which we tend to forget, there are lingering shadows of Afghanistan, the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan. I think that, in some ways, in the way that the British psyche has been so affected by the Iraq War, I think that the Russian post-Soviet psyche has been incredibly stamped by the experience of the catastrophic and hugely costly intervention in Afghanistan. And that's when the Soldiers' Mothers Group really became one of the leading civic organizations in the last days of the Soviet Union. The role of the Afghan veterans in actually toppling the Soviet regime, I think, is one of the sort of underestimated phenomena of recent years. So, you know, there are a lot of things that come together in that demonstration. But I'd also like to add something else, because I think this may be taking it too far, but I think there is a sense maybe in which Putin understands that he let a potential monster out when he annexed Crimea. Although it gave him huge popularity, it raised expectations among a lot of ordinary Soviet-era Russians that Putin would then go into eastern Ukraine and then he would take Kiev. And lo and behold, you would have the kernel of the former Soviet empire back intact. And personally, I think that's absolutely the last thing that Putin either wanted or had in mind. And I think it may suit him in a way to allow these sort of demonstrations as a show that the public in Russia is not united on the subject of Ukraine.
Just before we move on, as Mary says, normally anything that kind of seems to hint at a kind of opposition to, you know, President Putin is quickly put down. What's your take on why he may be giving a little bit more kind of room for them?
I mean, I guess one other thing that would be fresh in Putin's mind are the pro-democracy rallies only about 18 months ago, these enormous anti-Putin protests in Moscow and other Russian cities, which saw, I mean, not just several thousand, but in some cases tens of thousands, sometimes estimated as hundreds of thousands. So, I mean, Putin would know in the back of his mind, too, that there's an enormous amount of discontent in the country, and he has to manage that. I mean, that discontent hasn't gone away just because of what's been happening in Ukraine. In fact, it's probably exacerbated. So, you know, I think despotic leaders often do this. They need to kind of turn on the release valve a little bit. They need to give people a little bit of room to express themselves, a little bit of controlled space in which to voice their anger in order to kind of save the government from something more substantial down the track. So that's my guess of some of the things that are in the back of Putin's mind at the moment.
Now, briefly and finally, we're going to look at a story which is about Norway. It's revealed that it's going to pay Liberia $150 million to end deforestation completely by 2020. The scheme was confirmed at a UN climate panel in New York. Mary, a good thing or a bad thing? Should there be Western governments going in, giving cash, telling African countries how to run themselves and how to organise themselves? Or should it be down to somebody actually in Liberia saying, actually, enough is enough, we need to run this at a ground, you know, at our own kind of ground level?
Well, in some ways, it's sort of back to the first question and the original question, which is how far can other people intervene to try and make people do what you want them to do and what we regard as the right thing? So, I mean, I think your ambivalence is absolutely right. Obviously, in the sort of bigger picture, you would say, well, if that's what it takes to end or at least scale back deforestation in any African country, but, you know, let's start with Liberia, then that is a good thing. And I think maybe the impression of sort of Western colonialism is marginally softened by the fact that quite a lot of money is involved here.
Phil, we often read about these stories about deforestation, and it's always given the impression that, you know, it would just take a little bit of willpower and actually what's going on is just ignorant behaviour. But in fact, people chop down trees because they have no fuel, and people chop down trees because they have no money. And until you change that, you can't just stop one thing without providing the other, can you?
No, that's right. There are some really fundamental economic questions at play here. I mean, one is that you do have an enormous amount of illegal and kind of ad hoc logging that's done by local people in West Africa. I mean, I grew up in this part of the continent, and I remember logging being a big part of people's sort of everyday subsistence. So you would need to kind of address the economic need that drives people to do that. But in Liberia, the bigger issue is, in fact, that the government signed these massive licenses with international logging firms as recently as 2 years ago that guaranteed that something like 60% of the country's forests could be cut down by these multinational corporations. So it's not just a local economic issue, but there's also a national economic question here. I think there's one other sort of issue, though, that this throws a spotlight on, and it's that Actually, this is one of the first times, I think, that countries in the global north have recognized that it's very difficult to ask developing countries to pull their weight in terms of dealing with climate change. And this has been one of the big complaints at many of the international climate conferences, that all of these targets have been set. And that's fine for northern, you know, very developed economies to deal with. It's much harder for countries in the global south with much weaker economies to actually reform themselves in such a way that they could deal with climate change. This, I think, at the very least by the Norwegians, is an admission that that's a very difficult thing to do. And there may need to be a financial contribution by more developed countries to assist the global south in meeting these climate targets.
Well, there's lots more to say on this, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Mary Jacewski of the Independent here in London and Phil Clark of the School of African and Oriental Studies, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, review the latest music releases, and trace the history of black cinema through its posters.
There has been a separate cinema, something that kind of paralleled the Hollywood system and the regular system that marginalized blacks, and something that made African Americans a little bit more proud.
But first, here's James Luckhurst with the latest world news headlines.
President Obama has hailed the support of Arab nations, in airstrikes on Islamic State militants, saying it was not America's fight alone. Speaking hours after the US and five Arab allies launched their first airstrikes against IS in Syria, he said there were many more offers of help from across the world. Israeli troops have shot and killed two Palestinians in the West Bank city of Hebron. The military said there were members of Hamas responsible for the killing of three Israeli youths in June, an attack that led to the Gaza war. Reports say an 18-year-old man who had made threats against Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has been shot dead in Melbourne. The man had been under surveillance as a person of interest and was being investigated over claims of terrorism. World leaders, including US President Obama, are holding a summit on climate change at the United Nations. The aim at the New York meeting is to galvanize member states to sign up to a comprehensive new global climate agreement at talks in Paris next year. Hong Kong's striking students have given the city's leader 48 hours to honor his promise to listen to the people. They're threatening further action if he fails to respond to their demands for greater democracy. And the World Health Organization is warning that the Ebola outbreak in West Africa could infect tens of thousands of people in the next few weeks. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, James, and welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 18:32, which means it's 21:32 in Moscow and 14:32 even in Rio de Janeiro. And that's where we're heading now, because we're going to be speaking to Sheena Roster, who joins me on the line. Sheena, when I was in Brazil with you, seeing you not long ago, it was a time of demonstrations about bus fares. The presidential elections are on, and oddly, this hasn't been topic at all, has it?
Hi there. Yes, this has not even been a slight mention, and we're just 2 weeks ahead of the, not even 2 weeks, a week and a half ahead of the first round vote for the presidential elections here, and none of the presidents have spoken about it at all. Just a reminder to the listeners, basically, back in June 2013, protests really did start to kick off in here in Brazil over a 20-cent rise in bus fares. That would be 20 Brazilian reais cents, and that was what really got people talking and really got Brazilians more politically conscious, but it hasn't been brought up here at all. And the main issue is because transport is not a federal issue, but of course they can fund municipal transportation links a bit more if they choose to, but it hasn't even been touched on.
But do you feel that issue has kind of gone away then? Even in the run-up to into the World Cup, we saw so many demonstrations in the last days before the games began about transport, about bus fares. Is that issue dead now, or do you think that it's kind of lingering in people's minds and they feel frustrated that it isn't coming up in the presidential election?
The issue certainly isn't dead because Brazilians do have to spend a lot on public transport, namely the people who need it most, which would be people who have lower income. They tend to spend about a third of their income just simply getting around, namely to their jobs. So the issue hasn't gone away, but I feel that people have become rather apathetic about these protests because when these protests did originally start in June 2013, the main issue, the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, was these bus fare increases. But then, of course, all the other problems, all the other social problems that Brazil has, namely the high amount of taxes and the poor public services, specifically in health and education, which aren't offered to the public very well, those took the forefront, and those issues, health and education, are main issues that are being spoken about in the presidential election. But none of the main presidential candidates are speaking about the protests and especially these bus fare increases, which were what started all the protests. So they're not touching on the discontent, mainly because they don't want to awake a sleeping giant.
Now, a very interesting issue is the issue of abortion in Brazil. Brazil is a country where it's not actually legal to have an abortion unless you've been raped or unless your baby's going to be born without a brain. So officially, I believe last year, 5,000 people had an abortion legally, but 1 million women had illegal abortions. Can you tell us what the consequences of this are?
Yes, so this is a topic that hasn't been a major topic in the run-up to these federal elections like it is in the United States, for example. It's an issue that doesn't necessarily come to the forefront, but there's been two cases here in Rio de Janeiro that have arisen in the past month that have made it an issue. Namely, two women got illegal abortions and have since died as a result of these illegal abortions. So that has become a bit more of an issue. But none of the presidential candidates, namely the three front runners, which would be Dilma Rousseff, Marina Silva, and Eácio Neves, haven't really touched on this too much in their campaigns, with the only candidate actually talking about it being the Communist Party candidate, saying that this would be an overall health issue for the whole country if they did allow if they allowed abortions to be legal. It's not on the political ticket, so to speak, that this is the main issue coming to the front. And it is likely that abortions will remain illegal solely in the cases of rape and if the baby becomes brain dead. Those are the only cases that it will remain illegal, likely, because it hasn't really mainly been talked about. But it definitely will become probably more of a topic during the second round.
And just briefly, just in a few words, I know that Dilma Rousseff is at the climate change conference and will be giving you an opening speech there. What's she likely to say?
Yeah, so she actually did just give her opening speech not too long ago, and she's basically just saying how Brazil has a major commitment to global climate change, basically trying to make more sustainable measures in order to prevent increased temperatures that we're experiencing around the world. Of course, with Brazil having the Amazon, which gives massive amounts of oxygen to the entire world, she has basically announced in her opening speech saying that Brazil announces not just promises, but it shows results. And she is saying that Brazil will show results in becoming one of the front runners in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Sheena, great to speak to you. That's Sheena Roster, who's Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent. This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tupp. Up next, we'll trace the history of black cinema through its movie posters.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free
Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. The history of African-American cinema is, to many film historians, one of the richest threads of 20th century cinema. And for many years, one man attempted to trace that narrative by amassing an extraordinary collection of black film posters. Well, that remarkable collection has been brought together for the first time and published in a new book, Separate Cinema, The First 100 Years of Black Poster Art. A short while ago, I spoke to the man behind the book and the collection, John Duke Kish.
The role of the black actor had been so minimal, they'd been so marginalized in Hollywood films, that by the time Birth of a Nation came out, the racist masterpiece by D.W. Griffith, the director, blacks objected for the racism, and they decided that it was time to boycott that sensibility of filmmaking. And they took it upon themselves to find a couple of directors, a couple of producers, a couple of actors that would actually forward the race in the names of Oscar Michaud, Noble Johnson, William Foster. They redressed the balance and they created their own aesthetic in film. Over the course of the past 100 years, there has been a separate cinema, something that kind of paralleled the Hollywood system and the regular system that marginalized blacks, in something that made African-Americans, as well as blacks in general across the globe, a little bit more proud of their accomplishments. And that separate cinema were films that we discuss and illustrate in the book that kind of represents more about the black contribution to the history of cinema.
Now, tell me, one of the early chapters deals with Norman films. And is this a good example of the kind of thing you're talking about? Although here, interesting, the character, I believe Richard Norman was a white person who kind of supported this kind of fledgling industry with a series of several films, with all kind of black casts.
That's correct. Norman was white. He was one of the few sympathetic studio owners that it's about film. It's about, you know, it's about storytelling. It's not just about placing a black man in the role of a driver or a woman in the role of a mammy. It's not that at all.
And tell me, for you, the fascination with collecting, because the story is told through the film posters dating, you know, from the early days of cinema right up through to the 60s and beyond. Just tell me, how did you get involved with collecting these posters, and how quickly did you realize that they were such an amazing social history?
Well, it started when I was in college, and I was a graphics major in school, and a friend had given me a poster that had musical connotations as well as beautiful graphics. And I just loved it. It opened up my eyes to advertising, number one, as well as great, great design work. That just led to my looking for more posters of this variety. And after many years out of school, putting this stuff on my wall in my photo studio, people would comment and they would tell me things about some of the black actors that I had no idea the history behind and the historic content, the historic nature of which became my obsession. At one point, someone came into the studio and said, "Do you know about who these people are and all that?" And I said, "No." They said, "You better learn your history." And I did. And since the early 1980s, I've been trying to put a storyline to all of this that makes sense both visually and historically.
And tell me, some of those early stars that you have in the book, some posters for the first black actor to become a millionaire from Hollywood.
That would be, yeah, Stephen Fetchett, of course.
And who was he?
He was a racist character that Hollywood created, this racist Stephen Fetchett, you know, wide-eyed buffoon, who in fact was the first black millionaire there in Hollywood. But he took on all of these roles, which were comic and belittling, and took it to the bank. America soon tired of that, and he, later on in his life, he renounced those early days in Hollywood that did nothing to advance the cause of the black actor or the pride of the black actor. So, step and fetch it, number one. But then, you know, things went on to Paul Robeson, who was the chief actor who brought the pride of African American and the blacks in general as actors and actresses.
What began to challenge that racism? You know, was it the advent of the Second World War, or was it not until the civil rights movement that there was real change in the kinds of roles and therefore the kinds of cinema posters that we began to see?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all of that. Certainly after Birth of a Nation, people objected to the racist message there, and that was 1915. But sure, you mentioned the turn of after the Second World War. Yes, that would, 1949, 1950, they were the first years in which Hollywood really took the black actor and focused on the problems that black America was having, no longer just relegating them to the margins. It was about a black problem. You know, Home of the Brave, which was about a black GI, Pinky, which was about a woman passing for white, Lost Boundaries, Intruder in the Dust. Those are all kind of what they call problem pictures. And that's from the late 40s, early 50s, where the storylines really changed to be more about blacks and the problems that blacks faced. Of course, that extends into blaxploitation in the 1970s, when finally America and their black population stood up to the man, demanded their rights. They were given free rein in Hollywood for blaxploitation in the early 70s. It was great. It was great stuff.
Well, that was John Duke Kitch, author of Separate Cinema, The First 100 Years of Black Poster Art, speaking to me a little while ago. Now, well, it's time to pause for some music now, and let's stay with some of the themes brought up by John Duke Kitch and his extraordinary poster collection with a piece of music from a recent film about the African-American experience in the United States. This is John Legend with Who Did That to You from Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. Well, that was John Legend with Who Did That to You from Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's that time of the show where we review something from the world of culture. Today we talk music. A short while ago, Monocle's Paul Noble spoke to two of the founder members of Amy Grimehouse, an immersive arts and music night here in London, which has quickly become a big hit.
Mia Pollock and Alex Menace, welcome to Monocle.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello. And we're here to talk about Amy Grimehouse, which is your... What are we saying? Cult, trash, film? How do you sum it up, your night?
Cult, trash, transgressive, kitsch, film club night. We don't always do films. We sometimes deal with books and TV shows and things like that. So it's kind of anything goes, really, but generally film.
And so what was the genesis of this night? Were you sitting around watching a John Waters VHS thinking?
Pretty much.
This is a party in the making.
Yeah, we'd been watching John Waters and it just came to me one morning, and then... By the afternoon, I had set up the Facebook event and got the venue and sort of got it underway, started the artwork, and we sold 300 tickets in a couple of days. So that's what really got it going. And then after that, we just thought, okay, well, we'll keep doing this.
We had been putting on gigs, and it turns out that booking a film, which you don't have to book, is a lot easier than booking bands.
And so you're showing the films and then a party afterwards?
Yes,
well,
and no.
No. What we do is we have performers on beforehand, and if there's, the venue allows it, we will have crafting or, various things that people can get involved with beforehand.
A few interactive activities.
So if we've got a kind of huge venue with lots of rooms, we can do a lot more, but we always have a sort of cabaret element to it beforehand.
Okay. So let's go for your first music pick, which is Little Richard. Girl Can't Help It. What's the story behind that?
That is, I guess, a reference to one of our heroes, John Waters, who we've already talked about. I believe this may be played in Mondo Trasho, one of his earlier films.
If you're wrong, you're going to get completely lynched by every
John Waters fan. It might be a scene. Actually, I have no idea now. It might be a scene where Divine's just strutting down the street, being awesome.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it. Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she walks by, the mean folks get in gross.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she winks an eye, the brass lights turn to toll.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she got a lot of what they call the mole.
Can't help it, the girl can't.
The girl can't help it, she was born to please.
She can't help it, the girl can't help it.
And if she's got a figure made to squeeze.
She can't help it, the girl can't help it.
Won't you kindly be aware? The girl can't help it,
the girl can't help it.
If she mesmerizes every mother's son.
She can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she smiles and beefsteak become well done.
She can't help it, the girl can't help it.
She make grandpa feel.
And that was Little Richard, The Girl Can't Help It, from a John Waters film, which we will search the internet thoroughly and find out which one.
Yes.
You had a Divine event recently, didn't you?
Yeah, we were lucky enough to be asked by Peccadillo Pictures, who are film distributors, to work with them on the general release launch of I Am Divine, which is a fantastic documentary about Divine. Yeah, so we put on a bit of a show at the Rio Cinema. Yeah, it was good fun.
And are we talking lookalikes? Are we talking competitions?
Yeah, there were, as ever, as with our nights.
Lots of fab blokes.
There was a bit of dress up.
Right.
Yeah, there was a bit of dress up, a bit of a competition, a bit of a walk off.
Bit of a dance routine and a lot of fat trannies.
Flying fish.
Flying fish, I didn't realise that was...
That was a reference
okay.
to Divine.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite right. Niche.
Well, let's leave everyone there scratching their heads. Your second track is pretty much the name on everyone's lips at the moment, which is Kate Bush, who's staging the comeback to end them all after 35 years, currently playing at Hammersmith Odeon in London. And as I probably mentioned on several other shows, I went recently. It was a stunning...
Did you? You haven't mentioned that.
Well, now you know. It was an amazing show, but sad to say, you two did not manage to get tickets for this.
No.
In the 15-minute window of opportunity that
No, we did try.
Came up.
Yeah.
And so you've started a club night in response to this harrowing fact.
This was Alex's brainwave.
I was sat at home pressing refresh and started to become hysterical because I thought, I didn't get a ticket. And my immediate response was to ring a venue that we work with quite frequently and just say, did you have the 26th?
Yeah.
Available, which is the first night of her shows. They did, and so I booked it. And yeah, while I was still actually refreshing, had also simultaneously set up the Facebook page. It was called Fuck I Didn't Get Kate Bush Tickets, Kate Bush Night.
Quite to the point. Yeah.
Didn't get Kate Bush tickets, and then just buried my head and just pretended it wasn't happening.
That's because you were too busy setting up the Facebook page.
Yes. And yeah, so we held a Kate Bush night, and it was... very funny.
Thank you.
Kate Bush, wow, one of the many massive hits she didn't do when I saw her. Because basically she did maybe three of the sort of big Kate Bush hits, but nothing from any of the first four albums.
Should have come to our night.
Should have come to your night. Yeah, we had would have been non-stop Babushka.
We had what was her name? Regina Lalumpy lip sync to Wow, whilst simultaneously doing quite an extraordinary ballet performance. He was magnificent.
I'm sold. Well, when she does her, you know, her greatest hits tour in 5 years, you can revive your night and we'll all go to that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Cher and your third music pick. Where does Cher fit into the Amy Grindhouse world?
I'm obsessed with her and have been since I was about 12.
What period of Cher was that when you were 12?
Well, I actually found a kind of old album from the 70s called Rather Believe in You among my mother's record collection, and I just sort of fell in love with the cover. I hadn't really listened to any of it, and then started listening to it, and then just became, you know, as a teenage girl does, obsessed with her, and then shelved it because, you know, I became kind of older teen and it was
cool,
embarrassing to like Cher. But then I came out a few years ago as a Cher fan, and since then I there isn't a day goes by when I don't mention her or tweet at her or something. So this will be the second Cher night we've done that's coming up in September.
Yeah, we thought we'd screen Burlesque. It was time. It's that bad.
It is that bad that we think it's had long enough. I think, like Showgirls, it's an instant camp classic, and I think Burlesque is so terrible that it's just time to give it an airing.
I was born in the wagon of a travelling show. My mama used to dance for the money they'd throw. Mama would do whatever he could. A little gospel, sell a couple bottles of Dr. Good. Gypsies, tramps, and thieves. We'd hear it from the people of the town. They'd call us gypsies.
Oh, Shay, can't beat that, hey? Well, that was the founders of Amy Grindhouse, Alex Menace and Mia Pollock, speaking to Monocle's Paul Noble just a short while ago. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Mary Dzhevsky and Phil Clark. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by David Pleasant and Rebecca Unger, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, it's Section D with Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris. Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow, that's 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say, have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.